Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Thursday, October 26th, 2023. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Judge in Koberger case denies defense motion to dismiss grand jury indictment in the quadruple murder case. We'll have an interview with Moscow School Board Zone 4 candidate Jim Gray, and the Moscow City Council candidates discuss growth and demographic change in Moscow. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has today temporarily blocked Idaho's new law prohibiting transgender students from using school facilities that match their gender identity. The law was set to go into effect Friday, November 3rd, after U.S. District Judge David Nye in Boise said earlier this month he would let his preliminary block of the law expire. Nye said neither side had sufficient evidence the law would harm Idaho students. The ruling today blocks Idaho from enforcing the law until the appeals court can review the ruling on the plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction. Lambda Legal sued. Lambda Legal senior counsel Peter Wren issued a press release which said, "This ruling is a relief not only for our clients, but transgender students across Idaho, that they will be spared the indignity, stigma, and profound harm of this cruel and unconstitutional law as they go about their day at school. School is a time to focus on studies and extracurriculars, not to stress about whether you will be able to use the restroom." Legal Lambda staff attorney Kel Olson wrote in a news release, "For years, transgender students have been able to use restrooms consistent with their gender at schools across Idaho without incident. This order will allow that inclusive practice to continue while we pursue our challenge." District Judge John Judge in Moscow has denied a request from accused quadruple murderer Brian Koberger's defense team to dismiss the grand jury indictment against him. One of Koberger's defense attorneys, Jay Logsdon, told Judge grand jury secrecy can create prejudicial issues. According to a live blog account of the hearing at the Latah County Courthouse on the Lewiston Tribune website, Logsdon said six members of the grand jury that indicted Koberger earlier this year wanted to hear more. Koberger's attorneys wanted the grand jury to use proof beyond a reasonable doubt as the standard for indictment, but Judge said the state did not bring its A-game to the proceedings because the standard for indictment was probable cause, and he noted Idaho has used probable cause as the standard for more than 100 years. Jeff Nye of the Idaho Attorney General's Office told the court the grand jury operated properly under the law when making the indictment. Authorities are holding Koberger in the Latah County Jail, who is awaiting trial for the stabbing deaths of four University of Idaho students at their King Road house near the University of Idaho campus in the early morning hours of November 13th of last year. Koberger is accused of murdering students Kaylee Gonsalves, Madison Mogan, Zana Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin. Two other roommates at the house were not attacked, but one of them reportedly witnessed a masked man with bushy eyebrows inside the residence. Prosecutors presented the case to a grand jury this spring, and the jurors found probable cause of Koberger's involvement in the quadruple murders. Police arrested Koberger in Pennsylvania December 30th, where he is originally from. Advocates of renewable clean energy say the city of Boise and the Blaine County cities of Haley and Ketchum are leading the state in the transition to establish renewable clean energy policies, according to the Idaho Capital Sun at a policy forum at the College of Idaho's Langreusy Recital Hall yesterday. Renewable energy advocates said the three cities are taking the lead on the switch to renewables. Washington, Oregon, and Montana have renewable energy goals in place. Idaho lawmakers have not proposed any plans for renewable energy. The Idaho Capital Sun reports Idaho Power, which provides power in southern Idaho, is one private sector energy producer who has proposed goals for clean energy. Idaho Power has established a goal to transition to a clean energy grid by 2045. The three cities have also created their own energy goals. The Boise City Council unanimously adopted a goal to power homes on clean electricity by 2035 and a goal to increase natural gas efficiency. And they are planning an expansion into geothermal energy. Blaine County's elected officials adopted a resolution to establish a goal of 100% clean energy by 2030, with a provision for clean energy for the Blaine County community by 2035. At the forum held by the Idaho Center for Fiscal Policy at the College of Idaho's Caldwell campus, clean energy proponents from various public and private interests spoke to the future of green energy in Idaho. Forum attendees placed the focus on renewable energy policies, school vouchers, and open primaries.
Conservation groups are concerned about a mining exploration project proposed near the headwaters of the Boise River. The Idaho Copper Corporation is seeking approval from the U.S. Forest Service to look for copper and molybdenum used in steel alloys about 50 miles north of Boise. Critics of the project worry it will disturb the environment and also about the company's ultimate plan to build a large open-pit mine. Nick Kunith with Idaho Rivers United says water quality is a major concern.
Being at the headwaters of a major tributary to the Boise River, which is one of the primary drinking water sources for the city of Boise and the most densely populated area in the state, if there are any issues with water contamination or a spill, it's highly problematic and concerning.
The Boise River provides about 30% of Boise's drinking water supply and helps irrigate farmland in the area, according to conservation groups. Idaho Copper says exploration will have minimal environmental impacts on the region. The Forest Service is accepting public comment on the proposal through November 2nd. Similar proposals in the area have been struck down by the courts twice before, in 2012 and 2016. However, John Robison with the Idaho Conservation League says because of the mining law of 1872, the Forest Service can't deny exploration projects in the area.
If we do projects like this in the same way and putting vulnerable areas at risk, we're going to end up with the same problems or worse problems. Instead, we need to protect the areas that really matter to community water supplies and figure out how to responsibly manage mining moving forward.
Kunith says the Forest Service's public comment period is an opportunity for recreational users like backcountry skiers and anglers to be part of this process.
Whatever it is, if you use this area and have questions about how this project, even at this early exploration stage, will impact the reasons that you care about this area or what may change, this is the best time to have your voice heard and potentially steer the direction of this project.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
KRFP Community Radio is proudly supported by Ponderosa Rentals, providing quality home rentals since 2006.
October is Long-Term Care Planning Month, and a few tips can help people understand where to start when it comes to thinking about the future. Affording care is among the most critical pieces of planning. Bea Rector is with the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services Aging and Long-Term Support Administration. She says people typically can't rely on health insurance to cover these costs.
If somebody doesn't have long-term care insurance, then they're really looking at family and friends maybe helping take care of them or purchasing services out of pocket. Or, of course, there's the safety net program that is Medicaid.
Rector says in-home care or being in a facility outside the home can be costly. She notes that many people receive care from a loved one, which can reduce costs but also comes with burdens on the person providing it. Rector says Washington is the only state in the country with a program that workers pay into in order to fund long-term care. The WA Cares Fund will provide access to up to $36,500 in benefits starting in 2026. The amount will be adjusted for inflation going forward. Rector says the money is flexible.
That can be used to pay for a wide variety of things, from home modifications to wheelchair ramps to personal care services in the home or even services out of the home, like in an adult family home or assisted living facility.
Rector says it's essential to start planning early.
Really making sure that the loved ones around you know what you want that to look like, and making sure that you've got decision-making supports put in place, things like durable power of attorneys, etc., so that financial or health care decisions can be made by someone that you trust.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The West Bonner School Board has accepted the resignation of Superintendent Brandon Durst, a former Idaho Freedom Foundation analyst who was at the center of turmoil in the district this year. The board appointed former Priest River Lamanna High School principal Joseph Kren as temporary superintendent under a 90-day contract. The board voted 3-2 Wednesday night to hire Durst. The board voted 3-2 to hire Durst in May, but patrons of the district organized successful recalls against two of the school board trustees who voted for him. The Spokesman Review reports the board Wednesday night also appointed an attorney to negotiate terms of separation with Durst through the Idaho County's risk management program. Durst wrote on X, formerly Twitter, before the meeting, he was most proud of getting the board to pass an anti-transgender policy just before August's recall election. He wrote, "Probably the thing I'm the most proud of in the last 4 months is getting the most conservative, comprehensive, and legally defensible gender bathroom and facilities policy in the state adopted, a policy that I personally wrote prior to starting as superintendent." We now have the third in our series of interviews with Moscow School Board candidates, an interview with Zone 4 candidate Jim Gray. All three school board seats that are up for election this year are contested. Gray is challenging incumbent Don Fazio, who has been on the school board for 29 years. Zone 4 takes up a major chunk of the southern part of the city of Moscow, extending south to West Palouse River Drive and including almost all of the University of Idaho campus. Maps of the school board zones are available on the Moscow School District 281 website. In the other two races, incumbent Jim Frenzel is facing a challenge from Cody Barr in Zone 1, and incumbent Dulcie Kirsting-Lark is facing a challenge from Gay Lynn Clyde in Zone 3. I spoke with Zone 4 Moscow School Board candidate Jim Gray this afternoon.
Well, as you probably know, I'm retired out of the military, and after I retired, I went back to university to get teaching certificate, and I taught high school at a school for troubled teens while I was in Missouri before moving here, and after that I taught at a regular high school, and since I've been here I've been subbing for the four districts since I've been here 2004.
All right. How successful has the Moscow School District been in educating students in the past few years, in your opinion?
The school system in and of itself is not the problem. I think it's the curriculum, because the kids don't have enough outside experience whereby the youngsters are, well, put it this way, a lot of youngsters who go into the university here, a lot of them have to take remedial classes, things that they should have learned in high school. They have to take them again in university, and that tends to be a problem. It's not all the youngsters, but it's a fair amount.
And I've heard the incumbent say that Moscow School District has been very successful and has had very high graduation rates. But you're saying that a lot of students in the Moscow School District actually have to take remedial courses when they go to college.
Well, that's what I've been told about as far as the university is concerned. Well, yeah, I live across the street from a university professor, and this is information I gathered from them. I don't know if they're students from locally or not, but that's the situation that they're in at the university. Well, I was just going to say the school system is set up to teach for test standards, and as opposed to teaching subjects, like back in the old days, teaching to a particular test, which is the state test. And once the youngsters take the test, and they just forget the information, and that's a lot of the problem, in my opinion.
I see. What are your thoughts about the Idaho Freedom Foundation and their efforts to defund public education in the state, and how might that affect K-12?
Well, defunding the school system in and of itself is not a good idea. Because there are, even if there was to would try to defund it and was successful to some degree, there are so many students out there who couldn't afford, whose families rather couldn't afford to send them to any other school, because that's one of the reasons public school is available, because of those who would not have the opportunity to attend a school system.
Okay. Do you have any issues about facilities? I know the newest school building in the Moscow School District is about 60 years old, and there's a lot of talk about that, and everybody knows that it's very difficult to pass a bond in Idaho because you need a two-thirds majority vote and so forth. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, but do we definitely have a problem with the buildings, in particular Russell and the high school? It's costing, I don't know, just over $1 million a year just to keep the schools running because of repairs. Now, my thought would be to do what they did in Lewiston to get their high school. They got a bond approved, but they also sought money from entrepreneurs and other business concerns to fund it. I don't know if that's been tried here, but that's an avenue that I would try to look into.
As opposed to asking the taxpayers straight out.
Well, taxpayers are having a time right now just putting food on their tables. And getting bills paid. It would in the long run probably. I don't know how much of a portion the taxpayer would have to foot per se, but I would go into, like I say, entrepreneurs and business concerns, because the business concerns want educated youngsters who can accomplish the task, whatever the task might be in their business concern. And I know a lot of them would happily fund portions of the school system.
What are your views on how the Moscow School District reacted to the COVID pandemic? Of course, there was online teaching for a while, and then there was a mixed in-person and online teaching. I believe there were mask requirements. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, hindsight is always, interesting, but me and myself in my household, during the whole pandemic situation, we were not as concerned, because it's a virus, and viruses all around us all the time, and I think it was more I won't say propaganda, because people did die from it, but there's a lot of it that wasn't true. And a lot of doctors were not allowed to express themselves because the media, for the most part, took the side of the government and did not allow adverse opinions, even from professionals like doctors.
So you're thinking that the school should not have been as concerned. I mean, we did have more than 1 million people die in the U.S. of COVID.
I know. But if you look at almost any flu season, it's going to be about the same thing. But making it more problematic than I think it was, because the concern was seniors as opposed to, teenagers or elementary school age kids. That wasn't of a major concern as far as the virus in and of itself. At least even the government admitted that.
So what are your thoughts about the bill that was going through the legislature this year in Idaho that would allow parents to sue libraries, including school libraries, for $2,500 if they're found to distributing material that is harmful to minors? I know this bill didn't really define harmful, and that was one of the reasons Governor Little vetoed it, and the other reason being that he felt that it created a bounty system that could hurt or cause libraries or school libraries to close. What are your thoughts about that bill?
Well, suing the school system is not I don't think it's anything that should be prosecuted, primarily because it's the law in the country right now that adults giving any minor pornographic material is illegal, and not the library would be sued, but the individual, I think, would be the problem who. Promoting that type of information or giving that type of information to minors, because that's been a law since the late 50s, I think.
Right, and it doesn't seem that giving pornography to kids is actually an issue that's happening. But we have Moms for Liberty and the book banning movement that's gained traction in the last couple years. And it looks like they're trying to keep books out of school libraries that certainly don't rise to the level of pornography, but may validate students who are otherwise ostracized, marginalized, or bullied, such as trans or gay teens. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that.
Well, basically, it would be the same thing as books that Mark Twain wrote about. I can't think of the name of the books that he wrote about about being in the South and the names that were used for the blacks. Because I'm a black individual myself, and those were names that a lot of people are complaining about also. But that's just part of history, and history in and of itself is what it is. It can't. Challenging history is going to always be a problem, because history is written for the most part by the winner of the conflict, and a lot of the history is left out, because that's what I used to teach, is history, government, and economics, and a lot of history that is taught in even American history. There's a lot of information that's been left out, and a lot of information that's been misled the students to think certain things were when it wasn't. That's why I think the curriculum needs to change, so that they're actually taught the history and government, just like back in the day when they had history books and civic books. Because a lot of youngsters don't even understand how our system of government actually works.
I take it from what you're saying that you would be opposed to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's efforts to reshape the education system in that state, which we're seeing parallels in Idaho and a lot of other states.
Well, I don't believe in. Well, our school system, you know, for the most part, is set up to. It's a learning platform, and a lot of people, are trying to make it basically a social platform. Now, education in my mind, learning is one thing, but being but bringing a social, making it, it a I don't know what you want to call it, a social system whereby it's like in the military. But the military is not designed to be a social platform. It's designed to defend us from, you know, whomever. But making it a social platform, that's something that was tried back in the teens, 1919, back in the First World War, and even with Wilson and the like. But you can't. It's not set up for that. The kids need to learn what is relevant for them to actually go out into the world and make a living. Be it going to university or a vo-tech school, or just going out from an apprentice situation that started in high school. And if they wanted to stick with it, with a journeyman, like, you know, maybe electrician or a plumber or whomever, to get the, whatever certificates they need to get. But as far as being a social thing, I think it's wrong. So that, if that's what you're asking.
Well, there's the issue about social emotional learning, which you know, Moms for Liberty is opposed to. Does that fall under your definition of social education that should not be done, or what are your thoughts about that?
Well, that's part of history. Is being if that's what you're asking, that's all part of history. You know, understanding how the social situations brought about certain things or brought about certain changes. It has all been about the society and how the society would look at a thing. Because, say, for instance, back in the Jim Crow era, there are so many people who were opposed to it, but it's just like in the media today. I'm not saying the media is one way or the other, but the media today is promoting certain things, and it's causing other people who are against, say issues with people, to not speak up because they're afraid of losing their jobs or something of that nature. And that's not what our system was set up for. Our system was set up for freedom, liberty, and natural freedoms. And that's something that seemingly is trying to be stifled.
Finally, I want to ask you, since you did run for mayor a couple years ago, what connections there might be in your mind between your vision for the city of Moscow and for the school district in Moscow and the education system here?
Well, since I've been here, Moscow, for the most part, has not been business friendly. And I think it needs to be more business friendly so that businesses can come in. And like I said, they would put part of their resources into the education system because they will want the youngsters to have a good education, and we want our youngsters to stay here, especially if they can get a good job where they could support themselves and their families. The jobs is the key. I know there are a lot of jobs out there, and a lot of people say that those jobs are for certain individuals or certain types of individuals, but that's not a true statement. A job is a job. I had my first job when I was 12 years old back in the day, and it didn't cause me any hardship, but I tell you, it did learn me how to start a thing and finish it.
All right, that's all the questions I have. Is there anything you'd like to say to sum up, or any issue that I didn't bring up that you might want the voters to know about in this school board race?
Well, you know, as a member of the school board trustee, you know, as far as I'm concerned, my priorities would be student safety and well-being, and the quality of education. And then there's the interaction with the school board, with the community. I'm military. I'm retired military, and and it was Coast Guard, and a lot of the units I was assigned to were the COs had an open door policy, and that's the type of situation I would like to have for the school board. Have an open door policy. You can't resolve anything, but you can be a listening ear. Let them know. Let the public know that you are concerned about their concerns, because that's why you're taking the position that you're running for.
That was the third in our series of interviews with Moscow school board candidates with Zone 4 challenger Jim Gray. You can hear our interviews with Gray's opponent, incumbent Don Fazio, by going to the Tuesday, October 24th edition of the Evening Report on the KRFP website. Zone 4 takes up a major chunk of the southern part of Moscow, extending south to West Palouse River Drive and including almost all of the University of Idaho campus. In the other two races, incumbent Jim Frenzel is facing a challenge from Cody Barr in Zone 1, and incumbent Dulcie Kirsting Lark is facing a challenge from Galen Clyde in Zone 3. KRFP will be airing our interviews with Zone 1 candidates Jim Frenzel and Cody Barr on tomorrow's Morning Mix show. You can listen to the KRFP interview with Zone 3 candidate Dulcie Kirsting Lark by going to the Monday Evening Report on the KRFP website. You can also hear the Moscow League of Women Voters Candidates Forum for Moscow School Board candidates Jim Gray and Don Fazio by going to the Friday, October 20th Evening Report on the KRFP website. The winners in the November 7th school board election will serve on the board with trustees Ken Fonts from Zone 2 and Brian Kennedy from Zone 5. Fonts and Kennedy have 2 years remaining in their terms. Moscow City Council candidates Evan Holmes, Nathan Tupper, and incumbent Sandra Kelly answered questions about the growth of the city and demographic changes during last night's KRFP Candidates Forum. Here's an excerpt from the forum.
If Moscow is growing at the rate of 1 to 1.5% per year, what rate might be too much growth, too fast? And what, if anything, could limit growth in Moscow?
All right, this will go to Evan Holmes first.
Well, the two-part question, what is too much growth and what would limit it? And there's an interesting process that the Forest Service developed in conjunction with private people 20-some years ago called Limits to Acceptable Change. It's a process we could initiate here and use citizen input to have them tell us. I'm not going to tell people what those limits are, but we can kind of find out the general feeling for what the limits to acceptable change are. That said, what really limits growth is the actions of landowners, people that have control over, you know, spending, things like that. I would say that the potential for water shortages might, except we've handled that so well compared to Pullman and other places. Our population has gone up about, I think, around 35% over the last 20 years, and our water use has gone up maybe 3%, maybe flatline. So we're actually leaving the window open for growth.
And that was Evan Holmes, and now Sandra Kelly.
Without growth, your town dies. And what is too much growth? I don't know. And I don't think we're anywhere near that problem yet. I think we've been holding steady at about 1.5. Every once in a while, we might creep up to about 2% growth. But it's been very steady. We have development. Development's been, much of the development that we're working on right now has been planned for the last 10 years. And so it's that nice, steady keep plugging along, keep moving forward without having to all of a sudden grow exponentially because we haven't done anything. It's a nice, slow, steady pace, and it provides a healthy environment. It provides a healthy law enforcement. It provides healthy fire. It provides healthy jobs. I'm grateful that we have the industries here that we do. SEL has a new spot out on the south side of town, and I think that's great for our growth and our development. And we just need to keep providing to provide the right jobs and the right housing and the right financial structure to allow people to be here. And again, we're more like the tortoise rather than the hare. And we're just, I think, going along at a nice, steady clip. And I'm very encouraged about where we are and what we're doing.
And that was Sandra Kelly. Now Nathan Tupper.
I think something that frustrates a lot of people when it comes to a changing environment that's around them is they're not happy with what kind of change is happening. And so when we're talking about Moscow itself growing, if we're frustrated about it, it's more because people are not willing to become part of the culture. They're not willing to, you know, be a part of what is really good here. And Moscow is a great place to be. I want people to be here. I want people to experience the love, the joy, and the inspiration that Moscow's given me, and I want other people to experience that too. So when we're going to talk about growth, I'm going to argue that it's good to grow, but it's good to say, hey, we have a culture here that is welcoming, that is diverse, that is incredible. And the other half of that is to be sustainable. You know, we are going to be coming across a lot of water issues in the future. And so it's going to be up to all of us to ensure that we're using our water responsibly and that our growth is responsible and it's cohesive and that we work together and not try to be divisive characters.
All right, that was Nathan Tupper. The next question will go to Sandra Kelly first. And I don't see a phone call right now, so this will be the last question. Do you think there's an attempt to move Moscow to the right, our progressive community? I'm thinking about the annexation of land where there will be several thousand homes built that will be appealing to higher income levels and not a whole lot of movement on low-income housing.
I'm not sure that's really the right direction we want to be going or even thinking. I think throughout history, you look at people, some are on the right, some are on the left, and you have patterns where you have more progressive times, you have more conservative times, and they always go back and forth. And I think it's important that they go back and forth. Yes, there are a lot of housing going up that are high income, and kudos to the developers to see that they can actually sell those houses because they're able to. Do we need more affordable housing? Absolutely. But I don't really believe that's a conservative versus liberal problem. I think it's just a community issue. And I feel that there's a little bit of baiting there going on, trying to see like, oh, we're too far to the right, or, oh my gosh, Moscow's too liberal. I think we're a pretty great community. And I think we, either side, whatever side you happen to land on, you fight for what's important to you. Maybe you're more progressive, maybe you're more conservative, but you absolutely live up to those values, and we find a way as a community to work together. I love our eclectic, diverse little haven that we have here. It's a fight to keep it how we want it. I fight to keep it how I want it. Another person down the road will fight to keep it how they want it, and that's how we grow and thrive. But we don't throw out bait and hook to try and pit one side against the other.
That was Sandra Kelly, and now Nathan Tupper.
So this kind of follows up with a lot of the other questions about housing that we've been asked. And, you know, this question was asked explicitly, you know, these houses that are coming in, they're going to be higher income. They're going to be they're going to probably draw people into the city. They're going to encourage growth. But what I'm going to push for a second is that we as a community, we need to be welcoming. We need to be okay with people coming in. And we need to be okay with the fact that, you know, not all of us are going to agree. But on the flip side is to say that if you're not going to be a member of the community in such a way that you're helping the culture, if you're not helping the general environment, then, you know, people like that deserve to be called out. And I think it's important that anybody who's a political thinker or political actor, it's important that we're willing to express our First Amendment right to say exactly what we think about the people we disagree with. And sometimes that's a fun thing. Sometimes it's a terrifying thing.
That was Nathan Tupper, and now Evan Holmes.
Yeah, that's a loaded question. All three of us would like to spend a half hour talking about that. So, yeah, call us back. That type of housing and the cost of it has alerted me to the fact, because they can sell it, that we have changing demographics here. And the council can't legislate what type of people can afford housing here and who might want to live here. It's an irony that, and we can respond to it, but we can't control it. That is the changing demographics. But it's an irony here that it's a lot of the progressive side of the constituency through the 70s and into the 80s created Rendezvous in the Park and Ren Fair and a lot of the amenities here, Farmers Market and those sorts of things that now are attractive to a lot of other people to come here and live that don't necessarily bring the values that align with those that created this community the way it is now. So I recognize the irony, and I also recognize the changing demographics that City Council will have to deal with.
That was a segment from last night's KRFP Candidates Forum for City Council candidates Evan Holmes, Nathan Tupper, and incumbent Sandra Kelly. KRFP aired a separate candidates forum for the other three Moscow City Council candidates running this year on October 11th, which is archived on the KRFP website. Those candidates are Bryce Blankenship, Joe Campbell, and incumbent Drew Davis. Voters can cast ballots for up to three candidates, and the top three vote-getters will serve four-year terms on the six-seat council. The winners will join Gina Taruccio, Julia Parker, and Haley Lewis on the council. Those three have 2 years remaining in their terms. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, 30% chance of snow tonight, mainly before 10 p.m. Slight chance of flurries later, patchy fog after 10 p.m., otherwise mostly cloudy, low 23. Little or no snow accumulation expected. Tomorrow, 20% chance of precipitation, slight chance of snow before 2 p.m., then a slight chance of sprinkles. Patchy fog before 9 a.m., otherwise mostly sunny, high 41. Mostly clear Friday night through Sunday, low 18 Friday night, high 41 Saturday, low 20 Saturday night, and high 43 on Sunday. Currently 33 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can also underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. And once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. Flashpoints is on next, followed by Appearing Locally, where we feature music from artists that are appearing in the Moscow Pullman area in the near future. And that'll be followed by Maximum Rock and Roll, 8 till 9. And at 9 o'clock, the Academy's in with Not Dark Yet, on till 11. Right from the KRFP studios, and at 11 o'clock, jam band live recordings with The Ride, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is brought to you in part by One World Cafe, specializing in craft coffee, fresh baked pastries, artisan sandwiches, weekend brunch, wine, beer, and cider on tap. One World Cafe has a web calendar for upcoming live events and a campus location in the Janssen Engineering Building.